Hello and welcome to NPR News. I'm Tom Weber. We're at the University of St. Thomas for an event from the Broadcast Journalist Series. If every calling or mission or thing we value needs an evangelist, you would find no better evangelist for public radio than Joshua Johnson. He's the host of the national talk show that started earlier this year, 1A, which you hear on NPR News every weekday at 10 o'clock. In fact, if you're listening to this right now on the radio, you just heard Joshua hosting the show from St. Paul Live, but this is a recording from last night. Mind blown. Joshua Johnson, welcome. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Tom. Hi, everybody. Thank you. Thank you very much. Good to be here.
The evangelism thing I wanted to start with, you spoke with some staff at NPR earlier today, and I was taken by that. And I'm not trying to navel gaze, I'm not trying to hold a pledge drive here with talking about public radio. But I frankly wanted to bring it up because I've not seen an NPR personality really more seemingly mission-driven with the kind of, evangelism, that's your word, that you seem to task yourself with.
So you're kind of saying you've never seen anyone from NPR emote.
Yes.
That's really what
you're
getting.
That's really what I'm saying.
Right.
So why are you, what's up with emoting,
what's
Joshua?
What's up with this emote? Right. When we're supposed to be keeping it right at the range of Robert Siegel, as opposed to feeling something.
Where does that come from?
Well, I think we've got the best game in town. When you got a good product, you should shout about it. You got to tell people. And if we don't do a good job of modeling that to you, then you won't shout to your friends. You know, I think everyone in this room and everyone listening to Minnesota Public Radio knows someone who they wish was listening. And if we're not doing a good enough job of articulating to you what to tell those people to get them to listen, then you have to struggle in the moment. I love it. I love NPR News. I don't know how to describe. You should just be listening. Like, that's unfair to you. I think we have to evangelize first. We have to model it so that those of you who are fans can articulate it to others and can explain to other people why you listen, even if they never do, just to kind of dispel some of the stereotypes and the preconceptions about what public media are and aren't. So that's kind of where it comes in for me. I guess I just got tired of people stereotyping what public radio was supposed to be. I mean, I never thought that NPR would ever have room for me. I didn't see myself reflected in it. So when I fell for it, I thought people need to see this the way I see this, or at the very least, I need to tell them. I need to share it with them so they don't think I'm some unicorn who galloped through the studio door and no one can get me to leave. But there's a reason why I'm here, and there's a reason why I think other people should be here too. And just because you're a fan, we do not take your fandom for granted. You are paying for this content with your one most irreplaceable resource, which is your time. And we know that if we waste your time, you cannot get it back. And so we want to validate that by making sure you're aware that we're aware how important your time is. And if we don't cultivate that relationship, it will not only not grow, it'll atrophy and it'll wither. Something else will come along someday. There's no reason NPR could not have an honest-to-goodness competitor that would come right for our audience and try to snatch it away. So we have to tend this garden. We cannot assume that it will just grow through the natural cycles of the sunshine and the wind and the rain because God ordained it that way. Like, we have to work at this. We're blessed to have your listenership, and we have to make sure that we're good stewards of it all the time.
On the other note you made in that first answer about, I didn't think there could be a host who looks like me. You told the Washington Post, I was very blessed that I never grew up with the idea that public radio was just for white folks. You never grew up with that idea, that public radio was something that I could not have because I'm black, until I got old enough to know what other people thought of NPR. Then it became clear, this is yet another one of those areas in which my friends are going to say I'm acting white, but you go on to say that your parents and mentors did not do that. So are you talking about an out-and-out barrier? Because you found public radio. You grew up with the public radio, but then you talk about you never had to face this idea that it was just for white folks because that wasn't there in the early days.
Well, I discovered public radio through my mom. We were in Philadelphia as part of a summer program at Temple University School of Medicine for students of color who were interested in potential careers in medicine, which I was initially on a track to become a doctor before I came to my senses and settled into something steady like journalism. Shows you how bright I am. And she started listening to WRTI, which was the station that's owned by Temple University. And it was an NPR news and jazz station. So they would play Morning Edition, and then jazz midday, and they would play Fresh Air, and then more jazz, and then all things considered, more jazz programming. And NPR news and jazz stations tend to have a larger black listenership than NPR stations that just play straight-ahead news and public affairs. So she'd been listening to all this great jazz programming, and I grew up listening to jazz, so she kind of turned me on to it. And then she suddenly heard Robert Siegel on All Things Considered, and she discovered this kind of storytelling, and she came home one day, back to the dorm where we were, I was studying, and she was working at the program, like, oh my goodness, Josh, I just discovered the most amazing thing. It's called National Public Radio. And I heard, and she starts to give me her story of her NPR epiphany. And I loved storytelling. I always had an affinity for public speaking and theater. My other degree is in theater arts. And so it just kind of hooked me. And I had grown up listening to a lot of radio, either black radio stations in South Florida or Christian radio stations like the Moody Bible Network station. So I grew up listening to radio dramas like Adventures in Odyssey and the Sugar Creek Gang, and I listened to preachers on the radio. So I understood the power of the spoken word and of the human voice, but I'd never heard it used that way. So my inlet was her. And then once it became more of a career possibility, that's when it started to feel remote. Because by then I was old enough to kind of know what people on NPR looked like. And then I was like, oh, one of these things, not like them. And it was me. And I just couldn't see it. But the more that I got into journalism and the more I realized that journalism was for me, the more I knew I didn't want to go the commercial route. Because starting off in a local TV station means you're chasing a lot of car crashes and fires and murders and like the breaking news of the day. And you basically just face a police scanner and you just wait for it to belch forth stories. And that was not my idea of a life well lived. It just felt disrespectful to build a career waiting for something bad to happen to you, so I could tell other people. That feels vile to me. And I knew that I liked storytelling, but my heart wouldn't let me go into that kind of journalism, and I was conflicted until I was working in a local TV newsroom because I needed work. I was between jobs. I was like, okay, fine. It's a station in my hometown. I'll take it. And I got a call from the Miami Herald, which had been trying to recruit me to work in print. And they said, we have this new partnership starting up with WLRN in Miami. Do you want to do it? And that was kind of my way in. But I never would have thought to go directly for public media. We're doing a better job now as a consortium of NPR and MPR and PRI and the stations, you know, WGBH and BUR and NYC, of trying to recruit collectively, particularly among the diverse journalism organizations, the National Organization of Black Journalists, the National Organization of Hispanic Journalists and others, the Asian American Journalists Association. Like, I knew television could work for me because I grew up seeing Ed Bradley on 60 Minutes, who I love. I cried the day he died. He was my favorite. And Bernard Shaw on CNN, and my local anchorman, Dwight Lauderdale on News 10, and Ted White on News Channel 5. And like, I grew up, Willard Shepherd on NBC 6, and Ed O'Dell on NBC 6. And like, I grew up seeing black men on television. And that always made sense. But when I fell in love with public radio, I had no one to look at. So now we get to create the image so that that doesn't have to be a barrier anymore. So at least people can make an informed decision about public media that is based on more than just not wanting to be the pioneer in the room.
Are we, with the start of your show earlier this year, in any moment of potential danger in this respect? NPR, writ large, whatever you think of public radio stations and the group of them, now has a national talk show host who is a person of color. We check the box, we're good to go. What's next? Is that a danger, or are we thinking better as a public radio world that's not enough and that you have to keep going?
I think we're starting to think better of it. I mean, you know, my
my general manager at WAMU, J.J. Yor, is white. He's a white male. The executive producer of 1A, Rupert Allman, is a white male. But they hired me. I think there was a clear sense that they didn't want to go the typical route, that they wanted to have someone in the chair who represented a different kind of voice. And a number of the people on our staff are of various diverse walks of life. So I think that even people who are white and male recognize that there's a need for more inclusion, and that's not an impediment to their seeing that, at least not anymore. Mm-hmm. There's still a ways to go. There's a ways to go in terms of the way that we deal with story ideas, where they come from, how we present them to the public, how we report them, who we allow to tell them, who we recruit for. We had a conversation a few months ago about why certain jobs in public radio require a college degree. Why do you need a college degree to be a reporter? You really don't.
I have a college degree. It's in journalism, and I agree with you completely.
Right. I mean, there are plenty of people. Or why does it need to be a college degree in this or that?
I mean,
Peter Jennings never finished college. Why? We would have kept him out? I mean, it's all kinds of different inclusion, whether it's race or various walks of life or, you know, political persuasions or economic or education levels. We're beginning to think differently about that. So I think it's better than it was. The other challenge is figuring out what our goal is. Like, what's the target? Measure through the census the exact proportions of all the people in the country and then make our newsroom match that. I don't think that's it. Hmm. I think it is both to make sure we are not presenting an impediment to diverse workforces, and that even with the workforce we do have, we find ways to address our own blind spots, which everyone has. I have them. You have them. It's not about being white. It's about being human. Humans have blind spots. And about being good journalists who learn to notice our blind spots and learn how to work around them.
Joshua Johnson with me. We're at the Broadcast Journalist Series event here at the University of St. Thomas. And this is an event, if you're listening on the radio, recorded last night. The show 1A debuted this year, 2017, on January 2nd. You are 18 days away from the inauguration of a new president named Donald John Trump. That's an interesting time to start a new project, Joshua.
You don't say. Why might you say that?
It's a fire hose of things that are potential things to cover. And every newsroom is battling with this. And I would love to know what your process is for the purpose of your show and how you deal with the fire hose in picking what you're going to talk about.
Well, fortunately, we don't have to deal with the fire hose 5 days a week. We do a Friday news roundup where we kind of sum up the stories of the week. And the hour that Minnesota Public Radio hears is the international hour, the second hour. The first hour is national, which is mostly politics. So we don't really have to live and die by the DC fire hose, thank goodness.
Yeah.
Or else I would have had a stroke. On like day eight, it would have been over. And it's great because we don't have to do that kind of work. Winston Churchill once said, "You'll never get where you need to go if you stop for every dog that barks." And I'm glad we don't have to live that life. Even some of the Washington correspondents who have come on our show have said, "We have no idea what's happening. I've been in Washington 20, 25, 30 years. I have no idea what's going on." And they're just trying to keep up. So what we are able to do by dint of the fact that we're a national conversation rather than a national newscast or news magazine is figure out what's worth talking about. Not just what's worth us saying to you, but what is worth us discussing together. You know, what can we throw out there that's non-obvious, that's not just the outrage of the day, that is more light than heat, which for me is kind of one of my main North Stars, and I'll explain what I mean. Physics teaches us that everything that creates light creates at least a little bit of heat, but not everything that creates heat creates light. So it is with conversation, especially journalistic conversations. There's a lot of journalism out there that's designed to get you angry or get you scared or get you worried or just kind of remind you about the SOBs who are making everything bad in the world today. And it's all heat, but it very rarely illuminates. However, some conversations, particularly in public media, are trying so hard to be bright and they focus so devotedly on the intellectual and sociological implications of the particular outrage that many Americans are feeling, some that just can't control their emotions about the situation. But we're going to talk about it in a very calm and relaxed. Can the audience please be quiet? I'm trying to hear the grass grow.
That there's no warmth, and it feels cold. And humans are not cold-blooded. We're emotional. And our emotions are not bad. They can cloud our judgment, but they're part of what make us human. So I think the balance is being more light than heat, but not being all light and no heat. If we're all light and no heat, then we judge you for however you feel about an issue. Because we're saying you have to put your feelings completely to the side before we'll listen to you. What a rude thing to say to somebody who's got a legitimate reason for being angry or upset or worried. You might not just be angry about those people. You might have a legitimate concern about your community, about your family, about your health, about your parents, your spouse, your company, your school. I mean, you have legitimate reasons for feeling the way you feel. So our job is to find ways of having conversations that acknowledge people's feelings and allow us to continue the conversation to be illuminating. Once we validate your feeling, once we validate your perspective, then that kind of grants us permission to talk to you more broadly. John Maxwell once said, "People don't care how much you know until they know how much you care." So our responsibility is to first show care to you, wherever you are. And within that, hopefully, that buys us permission to illuminate, to expose, to contextualize, to investigate, to inform, to enlighten. So for me, the fire hose is not even, that doesn't really matter. I mean, I don't really hang out in the fire hose that much. We're busy finding other kinds of topics because we're a bit more, we're a bit less focused on the fire hose of information and more focused on this ocean of emotion that the nation is kind of wading and or drowning in. And trying to find ways to not tell you to get out of the water, but at the very least to just throw you a line.
So a tweet about a Gold Star widow, or a tweet about NFL players kneeling before the national anthem. Work through it for me in your head how that does or does not become a conversation that you want to have on 1A.
Well, let's talk about the NFL players in the anthem. I should note, by the way, that we have a team of producers who collectively put these shows together, and we kick ideas around together. So this doesn't all come out of my head. Yeah. I am one member of the team, but I am not, you know, I'm not the apex of the pyramid by any means. So say if it's the NFL protest, I mean, we could just, there's nothing wrong with just talking about the tweet, right? Like, maybe we just talk about that. Perhaps the best way we can go about it is just to hit, and we've had plenty of conversations where we're like, you know what, let's just open the phones, and we don't open the phones all the time, we do it when we feel like it has purpose, there's like it will add to the conversation. But let's just open the phones and let people talk. Sometimes letting you vent is the best thing we can do, especially if we're letting you vent to a panel of people with insight. So you're not just screaming into the ether, like you're talking to people who get it, and who will listen to you and provide some light to your heat. We don't have to tell you to calm down. Sometimes the best thing to do is be like, let's just check in. Like after Las Vegas, the shooting, just allowing people to call and contact us and just say, how are you doing? Like the whole, like the focus for that hour was just, are you okay?
Was this the Monday? Because it happened on a Sunday night.
It was
night.
Either the Monday or the Tuesday.
So
we're
Monday
just like,
or Tuesday.
Right. And our focus for the hour was just opening the phones and saying, hey, are you okay? Because we're all hurting in our newsroom. And we figure that you might be too. So can we just like spend an hour taking care of one another and just listening? You might not be able to talk to anyone about this. Like you might not know anyone in your life who you would trust to have this conversation with without it becoming about, say, guns, for example. Like you don't want to have the gun conversation right now. You just need a little care for your raw emotions. You just need someone to say, I'm so worried. I'm so freaked out. I can't believe what that guy did. Those families are never going to be right. I can't imagine if that happened to one of my loved ones. What are we going to do as this country? What is the world coming to? Oh, my God, I'm so worried. I was almost in Las Vegas. I was thinking about taking that trip, and now I'm thinking about going to a concert, and now I'm not sure. I'm just worried. Like, maybe that's what you need. And sometimes we're so caught up as journalists trying to find the light in the story, we lose sight of the fact that sometimes we just need to help vent the heat. So maybe, to the NFL example, one option is just to be a heat vent and just say, let's open the phones. There's nothing inherently wrong with that. It might not be our highest form of illuminating journalism, but there's nothing really wrong with just saying, we know you're ticked about this. Let's just talk. We could also peel off a piece of that. So there's the NFL thing. There's the anthem. There's disrespecting the military. There's disrespecting the flag. So here is a few ways to think this through. The core issue with all of this is police brutality. We could choose to ignore the whole controversy and say, let's not lose sight of what this is actually about. In this hour, we're going to discuss what the players are actually angry about, which is police brutality. And maybe we do an hour about that. Maybe we do an hour about workplace speech, which we've done. Do you have the right to express yourself politically at work?
Which these are players in the NFL. That's work.
It is work. And how does the First Amendment apply to that? That could be part of the conversation. Maybe we talk about, and I believe we did this conversation, what it means to respect the flag. What does that mean to you? It's funny because the United States Code has a section about flags and patriotic symbols. And the U.S. Code, which is not enforceable by law, says that there are many violations in how you treat an American flag, such as holding it horizontally, like they do over the field at every NFL game. Like using it as part of an article of clothing, including an athletic uniform. Like using it for any form of commercial enterprise, like every NFL game since ever. So that could be part of the conversation. Just the hypocrisy in the argument of saying, well, wait a minute. You have a problem with these players, but you are violating the flag code with every single game. And then playing around with that. Maybe we talk to fans about how they feel. There's lots of different ways to do it. And there's no one right answer. But sometimes it's okay to just kind of hit it between the eyes. This thing happened. What do you think? Let's take what you think and put it to our experts and have a conversation.
Just to use that example one more moment here. If you do the show and have the conversation about police brutality, which is what the players are saying is the focus of why we're doing this, we seem to live in, and maybe it's always been this way, but there seems to be that narrative or that perception then that you are therefore biased because you have framed the conversation from the position of talking about police brutality, whereas, you know, people who are very much not talking about police brutality are ignoring that. The president's tweets are talking about disrespecting the flag and the national anthem, and therefore, if you, even though you're focusing on what the players want the focus to be, that is somehow biased. Do you care? Do you care that is out there as a...
To an extent, yeah. I mean, and remember, this doesn't have to be the whole hour. We could do, for example, one segment on, and because it's a three-segment show, we could do segment A about the NFL anthem protest and then zoom out in segments B and C and talk about police brutality. We could do it the other way around. Like, we can chop up the hour basically however we want. And we're 5 days a week. We don't have to do the whole thing in one day, right? We could do part of it on one day, part of it on another day. It could be a series. It could be sporadic. We have myriad options. And no matter how we do it, I guarantee you someone is going to complain. But that's fine, too. Like, if you have a legitimate complaint, we're not perfect. Maybe we did screw it up. Like, maybe there was a better way we could do it. And as long as we're paying attention, that's fine. We can deal with the criticism, particularly if it's thoughtful. You know, I heard the show. I wanted to complain about the way you handled this thing. I noticed you talked to this person and that person. I wish you'd make time to talk to someone who had this point of view because such and such. Thank you for doing the best you can with a good show. I'd love to hear back from you, but if not, this is my concern. Sincerely, Cecil such and such from Mankato, or whatever it is. Cecil is my friend because he took the time to make a thoughtful critique, as opposed to the people who just kind of sound like a wet cat on Twitter. The ones whose tweets are basically a version of, you know what I think?
I'm glad you did the wet cat impression to drive that home.
Because you learn so much from a wet cat. Mainly to stay away.
Yeah. 1A, what does that stand for and why should we care?
1A is First Amendment. And the First Amendment is, I love people go, oh, yeah. And the First Amendment is kind of the basic rules of the road for how we engage with one another in a democracy. Freedom of speech, freedom of press, protest, petition, freedom of worship. It's kind of the way that we're supposed to engage, especially with expressions that we don't like, right? I mean, the First Amendment is not really designed to protect you. It's to protect you from government not liking you, not liking what you have to say. It was very astute of the founders not to say, you shall have the right to freedom of religion. Remember what the First Amendment says. It says, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press or of the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for redress of grievances. It's not for you. It's against government. So we try to operate in that space that was set aside and protected for us and make sure that we as Americans are being good stewards of this civic space and talking about when it doesn't quite work. That's one piece. The other piece comes from my background in journalism. I, as was mentioned, I worked in Miami as part of the radio partnership with the Miami Herald. And the Miami Herald calls its front page, page 1A. And those are the kind of stories I want us to do, are the stories that would end up there. The ones that are kind of above the fold, which are the ones that they're so big everyone's talking about them, but we might need to talk about them in more depth or maybe converse about them. Or they're the stories that are below the fold that aren't really like the breaking story of the day, but they say something or they reflect something about us that's worth discussing and that's just kind of a talker that's got people kind of buzzing and it's worthy of an intelligent conversation. So the name kind of has two meanings. Primary meaning, 1A is First Amendment.
You came into this job after a nearly 40-year I was going to say reign. I guess we could say reign.
You could.
By a woman named Diane Rehm, who hosted the show before you, the Diane Rehm Show. There is some applause here. Everyone, a lot of people love Diane Rehm. We didn't carry it here on NPR, but, I mean, she was a force, and she was hard to miss if you love public radio, and so certainly people obviously here in the audience know who Diane Rehm was. There's been a lot thought about how do you step into that, right? She steps away after nearly 40 years. How do you do it? How do you come in and make it your own? There's a version of what I've seen you say that says you weren't particularly worried about that. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah.
You weren't worried about, what do I do?
No. Because she left on her own terms. She retired when she was ready. We sat in her office, and she made it very clear. She said, look, in case anybody asks you, I've been doing this for 37 years. I'm done. I'm leaving when I want to leave. This is my decision. Nobody pushed me out. I'm ready to move on to other stuff, and I'm not ready to go sit on a porch in a rocking chair. Like, I'm only 80. I got a life to live. And so she moved on in her own way. So, you know, and when she left. Like, she didn't give me any advice. She didn't hover.
She's not trolling you on Twitter.
She's not trolling me on Twitter. She really let us build 1A as we saw fit. Very classy lady. I can't speak highly enough of how Diane Rehm managed the transition and really let us do it. So I never had to worry about filling her shoes. First of all, they're size 9 and pointy, so there's no way. And secondly, it wasn't her show anymore. It's not even really my show. I just happen to be the host. But I'm not the star. I'm just the host. This show is a public trust. It will never belong to me. I'm just one of many stewards of it. And our responsibility was to be a good steward of that time. So my only concern, really, on day one was coming screaming out of the gate on day one. Because, you know, a lot of shows, you see the first show, and you're like, what kind of train wreck is this finna be? Right? Right? You know what I'm talking about. It's not going to be quite ready. The paint's not quite dry. Like, what's going to be right? What's going to be wrong? And there's always that feeling of like, well, everybody, we finally got here. Well, we're glad that you're listening. we're a little new to this. And sorry, we're a little new to this.
And it's going to take us about, we're going to have to, you know, suck for about 3-4 months. But if you just give us some time, we're going to be just fine, and we'll get this all together. We couldn't do that because we were coming into Washington at a very, as you said, emotional time. Mm-hmm. And when the world was in need of what we were here to provide. So on January 2nd, we were going to hit the ground like it was game 7 of the playoffs. We were going to play as hard as we could on day 1. So they would know we wasn't nothing to trifle with. And we wanted to send a signal to the nation that if you are bracing yourself for 4 years of screaming and yelling in all corners, you're going to have to change your plans. Because we ain't having that. Diane wasn't finna have it, and damn it, I ain't either. Because we cut from the same cloth. We are very much alike. I grew up listening to the Diane Rehm Show. She helped me learn how to do this. And at a time when the nation needed us, I wanted to make sure that all the NPR stations that carried 1A could go to their listeners, to their communities, and say, stay where you are. We're still on the job. We ain't leaving our posts, because now's when you need us. So that was my concern, making sure that on day 1, everybody knew, whoa, hold up. This is new. I don't know what he's finna, but he sounds like, mm-hmm. Oh, shucks, he got something to say. Oh, okay, all right, I'll be back tomorrow. Mm-hmm. We want to make sure that you have something to tell your friend. Because every day is a chance to gain or lose a listener. And there's so much potential. 35 million people listen to NPR every week. That means 90% of the American people don't listen. There's too much potential for me to just be okay with you. You're lovely. We want to keep you. Don't leave. I want it to be to the point where people say, what do you mean you missed 1A? We can't talk about it. Go listen to it, and then we can talk. Because I don't even know how to have this conversation with you until you go back and listen to today's 1A. That's the goal. Because if we don't, then we're sending a message to the nation that when you really, really need us to do the thing we said we're here for, we folded. You spent all this time and all this money and all this attention, and you've bragged us up, and you got the bumper sticker on your car, and you carry the tote bag, and it's all empty when you really, really needed us. It was just marketing. It wasn't a mission. It was just marketing. I don't want us to go out like that. And I don't think our democracy will survive if we let it go out like that. This isn't just about a show that you like. We're a pillar of democracy. You and I are all part of a thriving, living democracy that is in trouble right now. Not because of who the president is, but because of who we are to one another. We're where the problem is. We are the solution to it, too, if we can stay together. It's like what that woman said to Ben Franklin when he was descending the steps of Independence Hall, and she said, well, Dr. Franklin, what have you given us? And he replied, a republic, if you can keep it. This is the moment where we have to decide whether we will keep this republic. And it's not that hard to start. It begins with a simple act of listening. And if you can't bear to listen to that person who voted for whoever or who believes in whatever, that's fine. We are here to help model it for you, to create a safe space for you so you don't have to build it by yourself, and to make it easier for you to do this in your own community. This is not marketing. This is a mission. And if we don't get this right, then worrying about what people think of us or whether or not I could fill someone's shoes, who cares about filling someone's shoes when your nation is sinking into quicksand?
Mic drop, right? If I were a good host, we'd walk off stage right now and we'd be done. But I'm not a good host because I actually...
Twin Cities, good night. Thank you very much.
No, not yet.
Before we go to questions, believe it or not, I actually think there's an even more powerful story that I know you've told, and I'm just wondering, before we go to questions, can you tell the story?
You just want me to preach all night long.
Just do it. I want to hear
the story. We're going to pass a plate in just a moment, ladies and gentlemen.
Open your hymnals.
Yes.
I want to hear the story about your friend's mom in South Florida.
My friend's mom in South Florida. I used to train with a guy in South Florida. He was a pro-level strongman trainer. And I used to do strongman training with him, which is so much fun. Except he pushed me so hard that I knew he was trying to kill me just for his own amusement. But that's not the point. The point is, one day I was in his driveway at the end of a Saturday trying not to die. And his mother, who's a delightful woman, came up, very nice lady, and she said, oh, Joshua's good to meet you. Oh, good to meet you. Good to meet you too, ma'am. Give me a second. I don't have any oxygen. And she said, so what do you do? I'm a journalist. So who do you work for? I work for WLRN, a public radio station. Oh, you work in radio. What kind of station is it? Well, we're the NPR news station in South Florida. Oh, well, what kind of shows do you air? Well, news and public affairs, you know, factual programming. Oh, that's great. Do you air Rush Limbaugh?
See?
No, man, we don't. We don't actually air. We don't actually air Rush Limbaugh. Oh, that's fine. Oh, do you air Sean Hannity? I love Sean Hannity's show. Is he on your air? Strike two. No, we don't air Sean Hannity. Oh, my absolute favorite, Bill O'Reilly. Do you air Bill O'Reilly? I said, ma'am, I'm very sorry, but he doesn't air on our station either. He airs on AM radio. We're an FM station. Oh, well, what do you air? Well, we have a morning news magazine called Morning Edition. We have an afternoon news magazine called All Things Considered. There's a midday talk show, very featurey, called Fresh Air. We have a daily business news program called Marketplace, and there's all kinds of other shows. Oh, well, that sounds very nice, but, you know, I'm sure you do very good work, but, you know, I'm conservative, and I tend to listen to, you know, shows that kind of reflect my views. Nothing against what you do. It's just I'm just not sure that it's really for me. I'm so sorry, sweetie. You look like a really nice guy. I'm just not sure it's for me. And I said, ma'am, that's fine. That's fine. If you don't owe me your listenership, I'm not asking you to pledge allegiance to my station. It's fine. But there's something that you should just bear in mind next time you're listening to your station of choice, which, again, it's cool with me. Sean Hannity and Glenn Beck and Bill O'Reilly and Rush Limbaugh, they are there, as you said, to kind of reflect your politics back to you. And because of that, 5 days a week, they will always basically say a permutation of the exact same thing. You know exactly what you're going to get from them. As you said, that's why you listen. But they will never have anything special to bring you. They have shown you their limits. They are all they will ever be. But when you are ready for something new, when you're ready to go someplace you've never been, when you're ready to meet people you've never known, when you're ready to take an adventure, when you're ready to explore insights and plumb the depths of concepts that you thought were beyond your reach, when you are ready for something new, turn to us. Because it's our responsibility to be thoughtful and original, to be enterprising and innovative, to be open and curious, to be explorers and adventurers. It's our mission to create a more informed public, one that is challenged and inspired and invigorated by a deeper understanding and appreciation of events, ideas, and cultures. That's literally NPR's mission statement. They will never have anything new to give you. We always will, when and if you're ready. And she said, oh. Well, okay. Thank you. And she walked away. 3 months later, I'm in Orlando, near Orlando, at a strongman competition that my friend's competing at. I'm getting ready to get back in my car, and I hear, Josh, Josh, Josh. And I whip around, and it's her, his mother. And she comes steaming over to me. I was scared. I thought she was going to slap me or something. Someone calls your name like that, and they come running. You, it's fight, flight, or freeze, right? So I froze. And she said, Josh, Josh, Josh. I'm like, what? She said, oh, my goodness, thank you so much for telling me about WLRN. I heard this story, and it was about, and she recounted the story to me, and it was amazing. I'd never heard anything like that. Oh, my goodness, thank you so much. I didn't know that radio could do that. I'm a fan forever. Thank you so much. I never knew. And she told me about her NPR epiphany. That's all it takes. All it takes is you being able to articulate to someone why you love it. That's really it. That's why I don't quarrel, for example, with companies like Fox News. No matter what you think of them politically or their views, don't hate the player. Hate the game. And they have played the game well. But it's the same game. It's saying, this is who we are, this is what we see in you, and this is why we need to get together. Now, I'm not a fan of Fox News' strategy, but I understand it. And because I understand it, it reveals something to me about how audiences work. So it allows me to say, this is who we are. And this is what I see in you. I see someone who's curious, who is at heart decent, who doesn't like to see other people hurt, even if you disagree with them. I see people who are patriotic, even if they don't always feel love for a country they don't feel love from. I see people who are explorers, who have a proud legacy, who want to leave the world for their children better than they got it, and are perhaps worried that they will be unable to do so. And I see people who don't want to wallow in the problems of today, but who want to work together to find the solutions of tomorrow. And doing that requires understanding the world we live in today and thinking through ideas about tomorrow. And I see people who want to enjoy their lives, who want to enjoy nature and science and art and music and performance and sports and all of the wonders of the world, who want to travel, who want to know the world as best they can, and want to really come skidding into home plate at the end of their lives, having used up every bit of life they had. That's what I see. And we are here to serve all of the nobility that you come with, and that the people you don't like come with too. That's who we are. And if you see that reflected in us, we need to get together, because together we can do something wonderful for this whole country, for everybody, and especially for you. That's what we're here for. Not just to inform you, but to make this a better place to live. I don't think there's anything better than that. I don't think there's any nobler cause as a journalist. I don't think there's any reason for someone to hear that and not give us a chance. But it's up to us to share that message. Because if you don't say it, and if I don't say it, it won't get said.
Joshua Johnson, 1A, thank you very much. So you didn't think there'd be two mic drop moments, right? You thought we had the one mic drop moment, and you're like, no, he can't possibly do it again, but I knew. Okay, we're going to do some questions here. Go ahead, sir, say your name, where you're from, and your question, and we'll take some questions.
My name is Tom from Minneapolis.
Hi, Tom.
And your last response here made me think of something I heard on public radio, that commercial radio considers their listeners as customers, but public radio considers their listeners as citizens.
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. And I think I used to teach journalism at UC Berkeley before I got this job. And one of the things we talk about I taught a class in podcasting. And one of the things that we talked about is how to kind of build and market a show. Because I wanted them to not just do a course on how to like mix the show or to interview people, but how to build it. And often if you're an independent, you have to figure out who your audience is, what your product is, and so on. And so we did this module about what it is you're really selling. And so I asked the students, you know, who has heard of, you know, Disney World? They all rose their hands. I said, what does Disney World really sell?
Vacations.
I was like, no, not really.
Theme park rides? No, not really.
When you get all the way down to it, every experience of Walt Disney World they describe, ideally, with one word. Magic. Disney World sells magical memories. Then I said, who's heard of Harley Davidson? Oh, hands went up. So what does Harley-Davidson sell? Motorcycles. You know that wasn't the right answer. Damn it. You heard the beginning of this. Shame on you. Get out of my class. What does Harley-Davidson really sell?
Well, we sell, like, motorcycle gear.
I said, you're getting closer. We sell an image. I said, oh, you're so much closer. A Harley executive once said, what we sell is the ability for a 45-year-old executive to wear black leather, ride through small towns, and have people be afraid of him. Harley-Davidson sells rebellion. They sell American-style rebellion. And then I asked them, what does CBS sell? Now, I'm picking on CBS because it's a broadcast network. This could apply to NBC or ABC and so on. What does CBS sell? And the whole class went quiet. They were like, this is a trick question. It's another one. We don't know the answer. How did CBS originally make money? Commercials.
How do you set the value of a commercial?
How many people watch?
How many people watch? So what does CBS really sell? Audiences. They're selling you. Doesn't feel good, does it? Now, that doesn't make CBS evil. Because the same network that brought us a game show themed around the smartphone game Candy Crush is the network that just celebrated the 50th anniversary of 60 Minutes. So it doesn't make it inherently bad that some networks view you as a customer. I'm not judging what CBS does. All I was trying to say to the students is, as you go into this business, just be clear on what you're doing. Make sure that the organization you partner with reflects your values, whatever they are. And if you find that, God bless you, man. Have a great career. Our paths may not cross, but good for you. I'm not going to judge it. Just make sure you're clear on exactly what the business relationship is, because when you think about it, you might not like it.
Say your name and where you're from and your question.
My name is Michelle. I'm from Minneapolis.
Hi, Michelle.
I am wondering, how do we get media outlets to cover stories that we really care about?
The best advice I ever got for anything, and anyone who's worked with me will have heard this before, and this is why they want to strangle me, because I'm such a pain in the butt. I say this over and over. Before we can tell a story, we got to sell a story. You got to convince me to listen. Remember, you're paying for the story with your most valuable asset. You can't get your time back. I often worry about some folks in public radio, in newsrooms, who will put a story out there just because it's important and it's necessary and people of goodwill should care about this story, as if people who don't care about it automatically, like you care about it, are lesser people, right? Like, just because I don't know about it and I don't care, something's wrong with me? John Dewey once said, it's the media's job to interest the public in the public interest. It's not your responsibility to be interested. It's our responsibility to be interesting. Does that make sense? So if you're pitching a story, assignment editors get pitched a lot of stories. You need to think through their sales pitch to their team, because they may not be the person to make the call. They may be pitching to another editor, who may be pitching to another editor, right? Think about the last great movie you saw, right? For me, it was Wonder Woman. I loved that movie. Out of 5 stars, I'd give it a 6, right? Yes. If I was going to ask some, if I was going to say, oh my God, we got to go see Wonder Woman. And somebody's like, well, what made it so great? Imagine they're in motion, right? What's the one thing I get to say to them about Wonder Woman to make them turn around and listen to more? For me, it would be, it's the first action movie I saw that was more about the movie than the action. I've never seen a movie do that before. Here's an exercise I give to some of my students. Imagine that you just came in from this great story and you're going to try to get it in your local paper, TV station, radio station, whatever. The editor is getting in the same building as you. You get in the elevator. I call it the elevator test. You're going to the top. He's going to the 20th floor where his newsroom is. What will you say to him about that story as the elevator is going from the first floor to the 20th to convince him to tell his editor? What would you need to say to him before he gets off the elevator? I would start with impact, right? Don't tell me about the rare blue butterfly that grows on the other side of the mountain. Tell me about what affects me that will change if that rare blue butterfly is not well. And then tell me the story. Start with the benefit. Start with what's at stake. Now imagine you're getting off on 20, but his newsroom is on 10. What would you omit from your previous version of the story to make it equally compelling so that he would still run and tell his editor, we have to do this story? Now imagine you're going to 20, but he's getting off on 5. Imagine he's getting off on 3. Imagine he's taking the stairs to 2. We have to be able to tell all those versions of the story. The 20th floor story is an entire hour of the show. 10th floor, maybe a couple of segments. 5th floor, it's probably a billboard, the 60-second intro that runs before the newscast. The 3rd floor, that's a promo. We have to be able to tell all those versions. But in it, there's still this kernel of the story, the benefit, the payoff, what's at stake, that's got to be in every version. Start with that. If I don't know this story, what's the worst that'll happen? So what? Answer the so what question. And don't use the word I. If the pitch is about you, it's weak.
make it about others. The story has to serve this news organization you're pitching it to because it becomes a partnership. You have the information, they have the infrastructure. If they don't tell the story, what's the worst that will happen to them? What will they miss? What's at stake? Start there. Start with why. Start with what's at stake. Answer the so what question and then build backwards from that. Reverse engineer it. And I think you'll have a lot more success.
We'll go up to the balcony. Say your name, sir, and where you're from.
Hello. I am a junior from Ticino Grace High School who would prefer to remain anonymous.
All right.
My question, I just want to know your thoughts because I have been somewhat following the violence that's been occurring in our political spectrum over the last year. Not too closely because it's kind of depressing, but and I'm a teenager, but I've been looking at these radicals on both sides who seem more intent on beating each other over the head with a stick than getting their viewpoint across. I just want to know your thoughts on that and what you would say to remedy that.
First of all, I just want you to know I have no judgments against you for not wanting to wallow in the news because it's depressing. It is depressing. It depresses me. I bought a PlayStation 4 Pro when I moved to D.C. just because I had earned it and I needed a break from the news, and I make no bones about playing it as much as possible. I got the VR headset. I went all out. So judge me. I don't care. I don't care. Judge me. So honest to God, don't worry about it. If you need to pull back from the news, pull back and don't apologize. In terms of the violence, I think my initial response would not be to say anything. My initial response would be to try and listen. I find that, like I said earlier, people don't care how much you know until they know how much you care. And often when someone is being violent or they're acting out, it's because nothing else seems to have worked. It's because they figure that you won't listen any other way. I think listening is a great pattern interrupt, right? It defies their expectation. It's when someone's like, well, let me tell you what I think. Well, I think so-and-so and those people and this, and if America would just, and if we would just return to, and those people over there, and that's what I think. Okay, so what you're saying is you think that these people and so-and-so and this, and that's what's wrong with America, and if we would just get back to doing so-and-so, then everything would be okay. Is that it? Yeah. Gotcha. Okay. What else? Notice how quiet it just got. See how the energy changed? It's incredible what happens when you listen. It's like a superpower. Now, granted, not everyone is actually there to talk. Some people are just there for violence. And I can't condone violence. Violence is not protected by the First Amendment. Violent speech is not protected by the First Amendment. But the anger can be addressed. The emotion can be addressed, no matter what the political persuasion is. Some people are just, their views are so far outside the mainstream that we can't talk. But absent that, and absent someone who's just in there to be anarchic and cause trouble, I would default to just kind of listening. And then once you listen, like you get an idea of what's really at stake, you know, well, you know, you look really ticked about this. Like, how did it get so fiery for you? Like, how'd you get so mad about this? Well, what happened was, you know, when I was younger, such, and then they'll tell you exactly what's at the root of it. And then you don't have to deal with the violence on the surface. You deal with the viscera underneath. You get to the heart of the matter. That's the real issue. The violence is a smokescreen for someone who's afraid. You only shield yourself when you feel vulnerable. No one who feels invulnerable carries a shield, right? No one who feels invulnerable swings a weapon. They're doing it because they're scared about something. And they're feeling hurt about something. And I know what it feels like to be scared and hurt about things in my life. So that's a way in, if they'll let me. And if they won't, that's fine. Okay, I'm not the one you're here to talk to today. I hope somebody comes along who's ready to listen. If you want to talk to me, I'm here. But if not, that's cool. Just stay safe. It's not always about talking. Sometimes it's just about learning how to be a patient listener and a willing listener.
I can't wait for the Wonder Woman sequel where her superpower is being a good listener.
Yeah.
That's going to be awesome.
And she wasn't a good listener in the movie. Like, that's one of the best things. I don't want to ruin the movie. We won't talk about Wonder Woman.
Okay, all right.
Right. I have made my there are fans of the show who have gotten used to the fact that I'm a pop culture nerd and a superhero nerd. So there have been Wonder Woman references and Harry Potter references and Star Trek references. And every time it happens, Twitter will light up like, oh, my God, he's a Gryffindor. Like, every single time. It's wonderful. Anyway, we're not going to talk about that.
Thank you very much. I've been listening to your program since the first day that you came on here in our NPR series. And what I observed in the very beginning was the opportunity to bring to the story the perspective of African Americans or other people of color. And what I'm wondering is, do you see your role as the reporter on a daily basis to help us see the story with the infusion of us as a people and what the story means? And I'm wondering if indeed that is a part of you're being at the table, helping to make the decision about the direction the program may take from day to day, and whether as an African American with the kind of experience and exposure and training that you've had, do you see your one of the roles is helping us see the stories that are presented on a daily basis from a perspective that may be different than your white counterparts?
I think so. I mean, yes, ma'am. In part, yes. I think that is sometimes part of my role. I don't view my role squarely that way. I think if my personal perspective as one African American who has lived my one life can help illuminate a story, then I'll bring that. I think the larger benefit that I've gained from learning to kind of reckon with my race and my journalism is not so much learning how to express life through the lens of an African American, but about learning how to receive stories about life as someone who's not. It's about learning how to look outside myself. Because if I want other people to look outside themselves and view life through my lens, I need to learn how to do it for others. And this gets to this notion of what we call impartiality, of objectivity. To me, the responsibility to make sure diverse stories are told lies not just on me. I mean, Rupert, our executive producer, everybody on our team, all of our producers, we're looking for stories that come from a variety of walks of life, and we're trying to find our own blind spots and engage them so we can tell those stories well. Part of what I have to do, especially as the host and as the one who's kind of purveying the show, is figure out how to kind of get you in. It's just like the question that was asked about how you pitch a story to a newsroom, right? Like, how do you, what's that little bridge that you build to get somebody in? So I've had to learn how to think objectively and kind of get out of my brain for people who are not black, to kind of convey what it is that, even though you're not African-American, what might resonate for you. We just did a show last week about a book called Borderlands, La Frontera, by a Chicana feminist writer named Gloria Anzaldúa. It's the 30th anniversary of this book. I had never heard of this book. And, I mean, I'm glad we did the hour. One of our newcomers to the team pitched it, and I was like, okay, this sounds good, but I'm just not sure how we're going to, like, sell this story. I don't know enough about it. So we're writing the promo, and the way we do it is that Rupert writes the promos, I write the billboard, the introduction to the show, and then we peer edit. So Rupert sends me his promo, and neither one of us knew this book. So I go back to our producer, her name's Jessica, and I said, Jessica, I'm struggling with the promo, and she's a young Latina. I said, when you read this book, what did it do for you? You've told me all of it. We got the facts and figures, but what did this book do for you? What does it mean to you? And she said something to the effect of, it made me feel validated. It made me feel seen. It was important to have my story told. And it made me feel like kind of somebody
understood what it's like to be living between two worlds. And then one of our other producers, who's white, said, I read this book in a feminist literature class years ago in college, and it just opened my eyes to this culture in America that I never even knew existed, but it's within our borders, and I never knew that it could be there. And I said, that's what I needed. Thank you. And I ran back in my office, wrote the promo, and that's what made air. So for me, it's easy for me to be lulled into that feeling of like, but the stories of African Americans matter and you should pay attention. But once we can articulate why, that's what gets people in. Because we can relate to what it feels like to not belong, right? Everyone just about knows what it feels like to not really belong. Everyone knows kind of what it feels like to be in that in-between space where you don't really not belong, but you don't fully fit in. And I think we have a sense of America being a complex place to the point where every day we're hearing stories about people from walks of life who are like, well, hell, I didn't even know to ask that question because I didn't know they existed. That's the bridge. That's the way in. So whether it's stories about African Americans or anybody, my responsibility is to be compassionate with people who don't automatically get it and give them just a little bit of a why for why they should pay attention, why they should stick with us, and then let you make your own decision. But I'm not going to leave you behind because you don't already get it. I would rather give you like a little bit of a reason and then let you make your choice, because then at least you know you've had a fair chance, right? You're getting a fair shake. And it's not just like, well, if you don't care about stories about black people, you must be a prejudiced person, you must be a racist. Well, if I knew where to start, I'm scared of this conversation. Like, every time I open my mouth about something about race, I always get in trouble. Can you help me know which way to go? Like, where do I start? A lot of people of very good will would be totally down for the conversation if they just knew where to start. And our responsibility is to make it easier for you to start. Then, if you choose not to follow, okay. But now you can't say that you had no shot, because we built you a bridge. Cross it or don't. But my job is to try to build you the bridge. And as a black journalist, when the bridge is built well, I've seen it time and time again, the response, including to that show about that book, is phenomenal. People saying, I never knew this could exist. I feel so good that I know about this now. I'm going to look into this. I'm going to learn about this. Thank you for opening my eyes. Worth it. Absolutely worth the energy it takes to just give you a little bit of encouragement to get in.
I just want to say, before we go to our last question, that the young lady who asked that question is a woman that everyone in this room should know. She's a pioneer in the civil rights history of the Twin Cities, Dr. Josie Johnson, and I make it a rule to...
Pleasure to meet you.
One of my few rules is that if I'm ever in a room with Josie, I have to say that she's in the room, because I think that's important. We're going to do one more question to respect everyone's time. But we have one more question. Your name and
my name is Mike. I'm from Hastings.
Hi, Mike.
Joshua, you're a very impressive man. I appreciate listening to you this evening. There's always the but, though, right?
But what?
Okay. Listening to you this evening, it came to me that there's a difference between a neutral news person and the journalist, which I take you as the journalist to where you're willing to agree that you have a slant or a bias. The audience here also has one based upon the laughter, the giggling, the heartache kind of when you mentioned January 2nd and 18 days until the event. I've listened to your show several times, and I've normally heard the experts for this particular episode, someone from the Children's Defense Fund, someone's to the left of the Children's Defense Fund, then Donna Brazile. And I, as a conservative, I'm wondering, how do you then come to the point of asking for public money for a slant that way? I understand 50% of the budget is probably public money, and the other is my wife contributes heavily, and a lot of people here contribute heavily. So, why should I, as a taxpayer and through the government, pay for something that's slanted, that doesn't go in effect evenly or my way, and I don't hear any conservative side on NPR? Thank you.
Thank you for the question. Less than 10% of NPR's funding comes from public sources. None of NPR's funding comes directly from the federal government. It goes from the federal government to the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting gives grants to NPR stations, or to public stations, who can choose to buy NPR programming. Most do, because the programming is successful, it's got a track record, it attracts an audience. But I do take the heart of your question seriously, that it can be off-putting to consider that any public money goes to something that might be kind of viewing you askance. I am riddled with biases. I'm a thoroughly biased person. We all are. My job is to acknowledge those biases so I can work outside them. That's what objectivity is. It's like the cancer researcher who lost a loved one to cancer. You can't go into the lab gritting your teeth every day about the loved one you lost. You have to clear your head, because if you can't focus, you can't function. If I'm living in my biases, I can't function properly. And so my responsibility as a host is to try at all times, not just when we're on the air, but when we're in the conference room, right, pitching ideas to one another, to try to make sure that I set that stuff outside and say, well, wait a minute, not everybody feels this way. Well, wait a minute, there are plenty of people in America who don't feel the way you feel about the president. There are plenty of people in America who would like to see a change from the Obama years. Now, my politics on that are immaterial compared to the reality that these are people we have to serve. I mean, we got to remember what the P in NPR stands for. We don't have the luxury of just being for a few people. We're trying to speak to the nation. I think one of the really gratifying things about our show is, and I'm not going to quarrel with your perspective of 1A, because if you hear a slant in 1A, then maybe you're hearing something that we aren't hearing that we need to know. But a number of our conservative guests, when the show was over, would tell us how respected they felt and how they were amazed that NPR could do that. Like, they didn't know that they could come into a public radio station and walk out alive. But they did, and they had a good time. Like, we've had a number of conservative guests. I think we could do better with having guests who are far more aligned with the president and not just conservative in a more conventional sense. Like, there are a number of mainline conservatives mm-hmm. who really don't like the president, who say he's not really a conservative, he's not really one of us. And there are plenty of Americans who feel that way. There are also plenty of Americans who say that Donald Trump is exactly where the nation needs to go, and we need to hear them too. So I think we're trying to do a better job of that. We're conscious of it. Do we always hit the nail on the head? No. I'll tell you right now, no. I think it's incumbent upon folks like you to stay engaged with the content and be communicative when you hear something that doesn't work for you or when you hear something that does. Like, if you hear something on Minnesota Public Radio that kind of hits that nail on the head, it makes a difference. If you contact the station and say, hey, as a conservative listener, I really appreciate the way you handled such and such a story. That means a lot. I can't even articulate to you how valuable it is to know we're doing something right. The other thing I would suggest, and I know we got to go, is that it's important for us to view you clearly as a conservative. It is more important for us to view you as more than a conservative. You are not your politics. You're a human being. And my responsibility is to do my best to just countenance you as a human being. I need to be able to view you as a person who comes from a particular generation, who comes from a particular racial and ethnic background, who has a particular socioeconomics, who has certain faith views, who has certain educational background, who has a vocation and an avocation, who is more than just a jet or a shark. And I feel like so much of what I don't like about being in Washington is that every day you hear some permutation of and to me, that is so, it's just dehumanizing. I mean, I genuinely worry sometimes about whether we're going to be okay, about whether or not we're going to be able to deal with the polarization, or whether we're just going to kind of let it burn us to the ground. We had a guest on once who quantifies social strife, this kind of polarization, and he said it's worse in the U.S. right now than it was ever between the Israelis and the Palestinians. It's that bad. Emil Bruneau, who's a neurologist at the University of Pennsylvania, he quantifies this. And I think if this is all we are to one another, then we can't do shows about nature without talking about the politics of coal. And we can't do shows about movies without talking about the politics of Hollywood. And we can't do shows about sports without talking about what we do at the national anthem. And we can't do shows about medicine without talking about Obamacare. What a lame world that would be to live in. What a two-dimensional, flat America this would be. I would just like to do shows, have conversations about the fullness of who we are. I would like to view you as you view yourself, good, bad, or indifferent. But I would like to actually have to get to know you before I can claim to know you. And if I only view you as a liberal or a conservative or a Democrat or a Republican or a donkey or an elephant or a libertarian or an independent, then I have instantly made the point that I do not care who you are. I only care what you are. I wouldn't want anyone to treat me that way. I've been treated that way. Hurts. Whether it's color or whatever, it hurts. I don't want to impute that on anyone else. I would like for it to stop with me. I would like to be part of stopping it. I would like to be part of giving the nation an alternative so we don't always have to go into the room as jets or sharks. And I think a lot of other people are sick of it too. The main message that I have whenever I preach about 1A is it doesn't have to be this way. It doesn't have to be jets versus sharks all the time. We don't have to do a show about who's to blame and what you can do to make them hurt. I don't think that's the America I want to live in. I want to make sure I see you clearly, but I also want to make sure I see you. Just you.
Joshua Johnson, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you very much. Thanks, everybody.